What's up, everyone? Welcome to the Young Turks. I'm your host, Anna Kasparian. And for the next hour, we have a lot of news to get to, important news stories to discuss, including the fact that former Secretary of State Don Rumsfeld has died. I'll give you the details on that in just a few minutes. We're also going to debunk some of the lies that we're hearing on cable news outlets like CNBC in regard to the housing market and how private equity firms snatching up all of this residential housing is not a problem at all. No, no, just a small percentage of the residential homes on the market. So we'll discuss that in the second hour. My fave news bestie, John Iadarola, the Dragon Daddy, will join me to discuss other news, including an update on Bill Cosby, who has been released early from prison. We'll tell you why. Turns out that we don't really have a justice system. We have a legal system, not a justice system. So we'll give you those details and the bonus episode. If you're not a member, I just feel like today is the day to sign up, because the bonus episode story is fun, but also unfortunate. And yes, I'm being cryptic about it, because you have to be a member to get the deets, to get the hot goss, okay? In regard to the fashion world, that you get a little bit of a hint. So you can become a member by clicking on that join button or by going to tyt.com/join. And for anyone who's wondering, hey, what can I do to help TYT out? Just click that like button, share the stream, and get the word out about the show and the important news that we're about to share with you. So let's get right to it. Former Secretary of State Don Rumsfeld, of course, the Secretary of State under the Bush administration, has died. He has passed away from natural causes. His family has released a statement in regard to his death. And while some may feel that it is not appropriate to say negative things about individuals upon their passing, I am not in any way interested in lying to my audience about what Don Rumsfeld stood for, how he helped to craft a narrative that encouraged Americans to support two incredibly disastrous wars, and his role in what was referred to as enhanced interrogation, when in reality it was nothing more than brutal torture of detainees. So let me give you the details. Let's do the obit. Let's talk about who Don Rumsfeld was. Rumsfeld was known for his unwavering support for the US invasion of Iraq following September 11th, the use of so-called enhanced interrogation techniques, aka torture, and of course prisoner abuse scandal at Abu Ghraib. That was a massive scandal at the time. Those photos are absolutely hideous. I mean, there were photos of the degrading, demeaning treatment of the detainees in Abu Ghraib. It was a giant scandal at the time, and I'm honestly curious whether it would be considered a scandal if it were to happen today, considering how much things have devolved, not only domestically, but even when it comes to foreign policy. I mean, the Bush years were absolutely awful when it came to foreign policy, but the Obama administration came in and essentially conducted a continuation of Bush era foreign policies, and even expanded the use of drone strikes when it comes to the war in the Middle East. So just something to keep in mind as we give you the details. So despite the fact that Al-Qaeda was in Afghanistan, Rumsfeld proposed military action against Iraq just 4 days after September 11th. And that's according to Robert Draper's book, To Start a War. Now, that was one of the most frustrating parts of the Bush era, because the American people were bamboozled. They were lied to. So many were under the assumption that Saddam Hussein and Iraq had something to do with September 11. What Don Rumsfeld did was he saw this tragic event in the United States where thousands of Americans died. He saw that as an opportunity to manufacture consent for a war that we should not have started. And he started that war by arguing that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. 10 years ago, ABC News interviewed him and asked him about that very statement and how it actually ended up not being true at all. Let's watch.
You believed absolutely, categorically, Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction?
I don't do a lot of things categorically. Anyone who's been around intelligence gathering knows that it can be wrong. I mean, Colin Powell's been around for longer than anybody in terms of.
He was devastated.
Of course he was. Everyone was. But my Lord, he's the guy who had more experience than anyone else. He worked hard with George Tenet, with Condi Rice. He prepared his speech. He went up to the UN. He made his case. And he wasn't lying. The idea that he was lying or duped is nonsense. He believed it. Our military believed it. Our military got chemical weapons suits on to protect them.
But you were wrong.
Oh my goodness, the intelligence was certainly wrong.
If you had known he did not have them.
I didn't know.
If you had.
I didn't.
If you had.
I have no idea. I have no idea. What you know today can help you on things you're thinking about tomorrow. It can't help you with things you were thinking about back then. Back then, there was reasonable confidence that he had these weapons.
The argument that there was reasonable confidence that there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq isn't good enough. Because at the time, there were members of the intelligence community that questioned the narrative of weapons of mass destruction. But those concerns, anything that conflicted with the narrative that the Bush administration was trying to craft, was ignored, was absolutely neglected, ignored, brushed to the side. And we, at that moment in the United States, decided to do a preemptive war in 2003. That preemptive war has been a disaster, as we know. We've spent trillions of dollars, not just in Iraq, but also in Afghanistan. The, again, enhanced interrogation methods that were used when it came to detainees related to those conflicts, absolutely brutal and horrifying. I mean, we broke all sorts of international laws, conducted war crimes. I mean, the Bush administration also conducted warrantless surveillance and spying on Americans. Just absolutely awful, absolutely awful. Look, you read these obituaries when government officials pass away, and I get it. You know, they talk about how many children they had and how wonderful they were to their families. But what about the families who lost their children as a result of these drone strikes? Or what about the families whose homes and neighborhoods were destroyed? Their livelihoods were destroyed. Their way of life was destroyed thanks to the Bush administration, thanks to the help of Secretary of State Donald Rumsfeld, and again, manufacturing consent for a war that we should not have been in. He famously, by the way, offered rosy assessments of how the war in Iraq would proceed and offered little introspection for the ensuing tragedy and fallout. The Gulf War in the 1990s lasted 5 days on the ground. I can tell you, if the use of force in Iraq today would last 5 days or 5 weeks or 5 months, he said, but it certainly isn't going to last any longer than that, he predicted in 2002. So he intentionally underestimated the impact of starting that preemptive war. He made decisions along with other Bush administration officials based on incredibly faulty intel, didn't even want to wait to verify that intelligence regarding weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. And so this is it, this is his legacy. It doesn't just go away because he's died of natural causes. And he died at a pretty old age, he lived a long life. In November of 2002, Rumsfeld also signed off on the Department of Defense's use of tactics against detainees in Guantanamo Bay, which by the way remains open, that included deprivation of light, forcible stripping, the use of phobias such as dogs and stress positions for up to 4 hours. Along with his signature, he wrote a note saying, quote, "I stand for 8 to 10 hours a day. Why is standing limited to 4 hours?" And mind you, these are detainees who, many of whom, hadn't even been charged with anything yet. Okay, there are some detainees in Guantanamo Bay right now as we speak who are actually innocent, have not been charged of anything. The US government acknowledges that they're innocent, but they're still detained because we created a problem and we don't know how to end it. We don't know what to do with these detainees who, I would argue, understandably, are furious at what the United States has done to them. So we can't lie about the massive role that Donald Rumsfeld played in these awful foreign policy decisions that are still impacting the people of Iraq and Afghanistan today and certainly are impacting Americans as so much of our finite resources go toward conflicts that we should have never been in the first place. Want to read a statement from the family of Donald Rumsfeld and then we'll wrap this up. They write, "It is with deep sadness that we share the news of the passing of Donald Rumsfeld, an American statesman and devoted husband, father, grandfather, and great grandfather. At 88, he was surrounded by family in his beloved home in New Mexico." So you can read the rest for yourselves. I wanted to offer my condolences to his family because regardless of how I feel about Don Rumsfeld, I'm sure that his family loved him and I'm sure that today is a difficult day for them. But we should also be considerate of the endless difficult days that people in the Middle East have suffered as a result of decisions made by our government, especially when Don Rumsfeld was Secretary of State. All right, well, let's move on to some other news. And some of you might not like my take on this story, but I gotta share it. So, the Manhattan District Attorney's Office is likely to criminally charge the Trump Organization and also the Chief Financial Officer for the Trump Organization, David Weisselberg. Now, Trump himself, and this is important, is unlikely to be charged criminally. And this has to do with possible tax crimes. And so when you read the details of what the district attorney's office is going after the Trump Organization for, it honestly does raise a few eyebrows because this is an investigation that's been going on for years. So if this is what they're coming out with, I'm a little worried that there might not be much in terms of wrongdoing by the Trump Organization. So let me make my case, let me give you the details. So as I mentioned, Trump himself isn't expected to be charged, his lawyer said. Weisselberg has rejected prosecutors' attempts at gaining his cooperation. So the CFO, Weisselberg, is not in any way cooperating with the investigation. So it's unlikely that, you know, if he is criminally charged and he is found guilty of wrongdoing, he's not going to be able to take advantage of some sort of plea deal. Now, is that David Weisselberg? Never knew what he looked like. Okay, David Weisselberg, there you have it, folks. The Trump Organization and Weisselberg are expected to face charges related to allegedly evading taxes on fringe benefits. This is where it gets important, guys. Pay close attention. Evading taxes on fringe benefits. The Manhattan District Attorney's Office and New York State Attorney General's Office have been investigating whether Weisselberg and other employees illegally avoided paying taxes on perks, such as cars, apartments, and private school tuition that they received from the Trump Organization. So this is about evading taxes. If we're talking about evading taxes on, let's say, a cash bonus, then yeah, there's criminal wrongdoing there. But if you're gifted a car, is that, and you don't pay taxes on that, is that considered criminal? I mean, it just seems like they're really reaching here. And I'm just being clear, I'm being honest with you guys about what we know so far about this investigation. And by the way, through the continued investigation, is there a possibility that they find actual significant and serious wrongdoing? Sure, but what they've come out with right now isn't really looking good for anyone who was hoping that Donald Trump would be held accountable for all the other financial crimes that he kind of brazenly would talk about, right? So let me give you more details. It's not clear who received the bonuses within the Trump Organization, which were likely paid by check or through a wire, or how much they totaled. Now, investigators are also looking at benefits given to other top executives, including Matthew Calamari, the chief operating officer of the company, and his son, CNN has reported. The two men who received cars and apartments are not expected to be charged in the initial indictments, but they remain under scrutiny by prosecutors. Okay, so lawyers for Trump, and this is the important part, lawyers for Trump and his company tried to persuade prosecutors not to charge the Trump Organization, arguing that charging a company over fringe benefits or employee compensation was unheard of. Former prosecutors say it is rare to charge an individual or company for failure to pay taxes on employee benefits alone, although such charges are used as part of larger cases. So that's important. There is some likelihood that this is just the beginning, and the prosecutors here are trying to build a case by starting off by attempting to prove that there was some tax evasion going on. But again, the question is, what form of tax evasion? Like, is it just that these employees were gifted cars and they didn't report it? And to be quite honest with you, if TYT, and this is like a laughable thing to ever even consider because it would never happen, but if TYT gifted me a car, I wouldn't think to pay taxes on that car. I just wouldn't. It wouldn't even cross my mind. Am I a criminal? Now, if TYT paid me cash under the table and I did not report those earnings to the IRS, then I am evading taxes, right? I think that's pretty obvious and pretty clear. So if the prosecutors really have a shot at proving these criminal charges, they would have to show evidence that there were cash bonuses that Trump Organization employees did not pay taxes on. But like, for a 2 to 3 year investigation, for this to be what comes out, I just think it's weak sauce. It's definitely weak sauce. Let me give you more. So I just gave you the statement from Trump's lawyers. But it's not just Trump lawyers. There's also legal experts who have weighed in on this, and they're like, this seems a little weird. So tax lawyers have said it's unusual to see a criminal case brought for failing to pay taxes on perks such as an apartment or company car. Usually, they say, those kinds of issues are handled with civil settlements and penalties. One tax lawyer said cash payments can cross the line into criminal activity, and that's true. So who knows? Maybe there is evidence of a lot of people getting paid under the table and evading taxes. And if that's the case, they should face the consequences for it. But for all intents and purposes right now, what it appears is they don't have much on Trump, which is a little frustrating because his own former personal attorney, Michael Cohen, testified under oath and had this fascinating exchange with AOC. Let's watch.
To your knowledge, did the president ever provide inflated assets to an insurance company?
Yes.
Who else knows that the president did this?
Alan Weisselberg, Ron Lieberman, and Matthew Calamari.
And where would the committee find more information on this? Do you think we need to review his financial statements and his tax returns in order to compare them?
Yes, and you'd find it at the Trump Org.
Mr. Cohen, I want to ask you about your assertion that the president may have improperly devalued his assets to avoid paying taxes. According to an August 21st, 2016 report by the Washington Post, while the president claimed in financial disclosure forms that Trump National Golf Club in Jupiter, Florida was worth more than $50 million, he had reported otherwise to local tax authorities that the course was worth, quote, no more than $5 million. Mr. Cohen, do you know whether this specific report is accurate?
It's identical to what he did at Trump National Golf Club at Briarcliff Manor.
Do you know, to your knowledge, was the president interested in reducing his local real estate bills, tax bills?
Yes.
And how did he do that?
What you do is you deflate the value of the asset, and then you put in a request to the tax department for a deduction.
So that is what kind of tipped off prosecutors in the Manhattan District Attorney's Office, and I think it makes sense to do the investigation. But so far, the outcome of this investigation doesn't really show any serious crime. I mean, certainly not something to the point that would incriminate Donald Trump specifically, which is why he is not likely to be criminally charged yet. But this could be the beginning of other criminal charges. This could be part of a larger criminal case. Obviously, I can't predict that, but it seems like there's a possibility that that's the direction this investigation is headed in. I also want to correct myself. I referred to the chief financial officer as David Weisselberg. I'm not sure why, but his name is Alan Weisselberg. So I wanted to make that correction and make sure to correct the record on that. But as this story develops, we'll give you details if there's anything significant. As it stands right now, to be completely fair and honest, because that's important, this seems like a bit of a nothing burger. We gotta take a break. When we come back, we have more news for you all, including progressives threatening to withhold their votes on the infrastructure bill. I love it when they flex their power. They should do it more often. We'll give you the details on that and more when we come back. Welcome back to TYT. Anna Kasparian with you. Please like and share the stream. I was gonna say scream. I might be screaming later. There's some pretty crazy stories in the rundown today. But please smash the like button. That's what the cool kids say on Twitter. Anyway, with that said, let's move on to progressives who are finally starting to understand that they actually do have some leverage and they do have some power as a bloc in the House of Representatives. Representative Ilhan Omar told Politico that she and other progressive lawmakers in the House are willing to withhold their vote on the so-called bipartisan infrastructure bill unless there is a foolproof strategy in place to ensure that they can vote on a second reconciliation bill and get it signed by Biden simultaneously. Now remember, this is what Joe Biden had promised to do. He said, we're gonna do this bipartisan deal because we wanna get something done in a bipartisan way with these Republican lawmakers in the Senate. But we're also going to have a second bill that we will pass and sign in tandem, and we'll pass it through reconciliation, simple majority in the Senate, that has all of the things that Republicans stripped out. Now, I think that strategy was dumb. I think that that strategy is unlikely to work unless progressives are willing to withhold their vote to ensure that these two bills pass in tandem. Now, Omar also, here's what her statement was, by the way. She told Politico, quote, we have a commitment that regardless of what happens with bipartisan legislation, they will give us reconciliation legislation that goes as far as we've wanted it. And so the reconciliation bill is supposed to include all of the climate action related provisions that were stripped away by Republicans. It's also supposed to include funding for childcare and also funding for elder care, the human infrastructure components of the Biden plan that actually made it incredibly popular across the country, even in red states. I mean, upwards of 70% of Americans are in favor of Biden's initial infrastructure bill. So capitulating with Republicans is, in my opinion, a dumb move. Giving into the demands of a bought off politician like Senator Joe Manchin is a dumb move. It really is. But again, if progressives are really willing to follow through with what Representative Omar is saying here, there is a chance for a positive outcome. So Omar isn't the only Democrat who has said this in public. The linkage is non-negotiable for me, added Progressive Representative Richie Torres, who said the bipartisan compromise excluded his priorities like affordable housing. As a result, he added, I will refuse to vote for any bill that fails to be linked to a larger reconciliation bill. The Progressive Caucus in the House actually did a poll. They have about 100 members in that caucus. We know that not all of them are actually progressive. But through that poll, they found that 60 out of 100 of those progressive lawmakers are willing to withhold their vote to ensure that there's a second reconciliation bill that passes in tandem. Now, Joe Manchin, Senator Joe Manchin, unironically tried to argue during a recent interview on MSNBC that progressives, they might be unreasonable here. They might be super unreasonable. Let's hear what he had to say.
I would hope that everyone would look at this as something that we can do. It's doable in a bipartisan way. Take that victory and then let's go. We know they're not going to go to the human infrastructure because of the adjustments of the tax code. I've known that from day one, but we can still go through the process knowing we'll probably have to go to reconciliation and then do what we can afford to do. Saying I'm going to not vote for the other one because you haven't guaranteed to vote for everything. We've never done legislation that way. I've never been a part of it in 10 years I've been in the Senate. So let's work the legislation the way it's going to be presented.
This is the guy who has threatened to block every piece of legislation in Biden's agenda if he doesn't get what he wants. He's been the one who's raised his hand over and over again to say, no, I really care about bipartisanship. I mean, my corporate donors paid me to pretend like I care about bipartisanship, so I'm gonna block these bills unless they're watered down. Remember, it was Manchin who persuaded the Biden administration to water down the coronavirus relief bill, and it was watered down. The unemployment benefits were watered down from $400 a week to $300 a week, and Manchin succeeded in implementing additional means testing so fewer Americans would qualify for the stimulus. So he did that arguing that he wanted to get Republicans on board. And how many Republicans voted for that bill? That's right, zero, none of them did. It wasn't really about bipartisanship. It was about ensuring that Americans didn't get the financial relief that they really needed, or at least lowering the amount of financial relief they would receive in order to ensure that they'd be desperate enough to go back to their jobs that pay them a starvation wage. That's what this was really about. Let's not get it twisted. And as The Intercept reported, and as The Intercept obtained leaked audio of Manchin speaking to the so-called no labels group of billionaire donors, Manchin knows that bipartisanship isn't a reality. He knows that the Republican Party is full of obstructionists who have no interest in working together, but he wanted to provide cover for his lies. And so he encouraged these billionaire donors to offer some of these retiring Republican senators jobs once they're done with their term, so they can, you know, sweeten the deal a little bit, and they can maybe vote in favor of a January 6th commission to investigate what happened in the Capitol. And that would somehow persuade the American people that all's well in the Senate, lawmakers are working together, both Democrats and Republicans, they love each other, kumbaya. But like, the bipartisanship in Congress doesn't matter. What does matter is how do the American people feel? And the majority of the American people, with Republicans included in this equation, were in favor of Biden's original infrastructure bill. I would argue that if you were to poll Americans right now, and if you were to ask them, hey, which one do you prefer? Do you prefer Biden's original infrastructure bill that had all of these wonderful components like childcare, elder care, climate action, or do you prefer the watered down bipartisan version that would privatize $100 billion worth of public infrastructure? I don't know, I might be wrong, but I would argue that most Americans, Republicans included, would probably enjoy Biden's provisions far more than this awful, awful watered down corporate giveaway that's now been agreed upon by the Biden administration and a bipartisan group of senators who again are looking out for their corporate donors. Now, I also wanna just note that Manchin has not committed to voting to the reconciliation or voting for the reconciliation bill. Manchin has indicated that he would support the Democrats' second measure, which some have dubbed the human infrastructure bill, but noted, and this is important, but noted he hasn't agreed on the amount and needs to see what will be in the legislation. So he's like, that reconciliation bill, yeah, totally. I will vote for it, except if I have a problem with the funding for it, probably not. I'm probably not gonna vote for it. I don't know, let me check in with the no labels group of billionaire donors. Let me see what they think. By the way, no one in the mainstream press even covered that. That story by The Intercept, and shout outs to Ryan Grimm and Ken Klippenstein for reporting on that, I think was such a huge story because it helped Americans understand the inner workings of the Senate, of Congress, what motivates these lawmakers, and it got no attention. It's absolutely mind blowing. Now, House Budget Committee Chair Representative John Yarmuth privately urged a group of senior Democrats not to draw public red lines for either of the bills, whether it's price tags or policy wishes. That's basically his way of saying to progressive lawmakers, hey, hush up, don't threaten us by saying you're gonna withhold your vote. But look, this is the time where we need to provide positive reinforcement to progressive lawmakers in the House, because they do have leverage. They do have an opportunity to pass provisions from the infrastructure bill that are incredibly important and would, in fact, materially improve people's lives. They have nothing to fear if they stick together and withhold their votes and actually deliver for their constituents and the American people. The only people who should be scared are clowns like Senator Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema. But if progressives actually fight on behalf of the American people, and it's abundantly clear that they're fighting to ensure that we're doing something about climate change, to ensure that we're doing something to compensate people who take care of elderly family members, that's work. They deserve compensation for that. If they fight for communities that have been neglected, that's your best shot at making your case for why the Democratic Party is better than the Republican Party. Give people what they want. They tell you what they want in the polls. Many of these progressive lawmakers don't take massive campaign donations from corporations. They don't take money from super PACs. And that should liberate them. Flex your power, flex your muscle. Why wouldn't you? What's the whole point of being in Congress in the first place? To go live in DC for 6 months out of the year? That sounds awful. Who wants to do that? No one. So do your jobs. And I'm not trying to be aggressive or negative toward them right now. It seems like they have the right idea. The question is, will they execute it? And if they do, I promise you, it'll work out well. They'll get negative press coverage. I'm sure they'll get pushback from the Democratic establishment and Democratic leadership. Who cares? These are people who are incredibly unpopular because they don't deliver. So if progressives do deliver, then we'll feel pretty good about putting them in Congress in the first place. All right, let's go ahead and take our second break. And when we come back, I want to dig in on how these corporate Democrats are attacking Nina Turner. Jim Clyburn is involved now. You don't want to miss the details on this story. Come right back. Hey everyone, welcome back to TYT. Anna Kasparian with you. Let's get to our next story. Corporate Democrats have their sights set on destroying the candidacy of progressive Nina Turner. She is the most progressive person running for Ohio's 11th district congressional seat. And recently we shared with you that Hillary Clinton had endorsed her opponent, a woman by the name of Chantel Jones. And now Representative Jim Clyburn has weighed in, and he has also endorsed, I'm sorry, Chantel Brown, not Jones, Chantel Brown. Now, US Representative James Clyburn, one of the Democratic Party's most outspoken opponents of Medicare for All, is intervening to try to halt Turner's rise in the polls. Now, let's be clear about what Nina Turner represents. Of course, she worked with Bernie Sanders in both of his presidential campaigns. She is an outstanding and outspoken proponent of Medicare for All, which is one of the most important policy issues in this country. And she's just an all-around strong candidate who stands for the right policies. So of course, corporate Democrats are coming for her. Certainly corporate Democrats who are funded by the pharmaceutical industry and also the private healthcare industry, they've got a lot to lose if we have a single payer system. They don't like it. And so they ensured that the very politicians they're bribing come out and support the opponent who is not a proponent of Medicare for All. Now, Clyburn said his decision to back Brown was not about Bernie Sanders or even Turner, who remains the favorite before the contest on August 3rd in the heavily Democratic district. But he took a swipe at what he called the sloganeering of the party's left flank, which has risen to power with calls for Medicare for All, that's the main thing, and to abolish ICE and defund the police. Now, the Medicare for All component of his statement there is relevant, again, because of who funds his campaigns. As the Daily Poster reports, Clyburn has vacuumed in more than $1 million from donors in the pharmaceutical industry, and he previously made headlines vilifying Medicare for All during the 2020 presidential election. Another sign that the pharmaceutical industry and the private healthcare industry is involved in this effort to destroy Nina Turner's candidacy is how they reacted to this recent ad that Turner's campaign put out. Let's take a quick look at that.
Something that continues to haunt me to this day is my mother dying at the young age of 42 years old. No insurance, no money in the bank. So when I fight for Medicare for All, I'm fighting for my mama, who's not here, and working class people who need to have health care as a right, not a privilege. The poor, the working poor, and the barely middle class should live a good life. Wealth should not dictate whether or not you have access to health care.
Now, the American people see that and they love it because so many can relate to it. In fact, Medicare for All polls well in Ohio's 11th district. Medicare for All polls well, period. Nationally, there have been multiple national polls that show that even with the corporate framing of the question that makes it seem like they would lose, you know, the access they have to the specific doctors they go to, people still want a single payer healthcare system. And so again, Americans see that ad and think, yes, right on, finally, that's what we want. But corporate Democrats see that and think, we need to crush her. We need to crush her. So one day after Turner's campaign put that ad out, corporate Democrats host a fundraiser with the help of the private healthcare industry. The Daily Poster reports that the very next day, corporate lobbyists held a Washington fundraiser for Turner's primary opponent, Chantel Brown. Among those headlining the fundraiser was Jerome Murray, a registered lobbyist for the Pharmaceutical Researchers and Manufacturers Association, which has been backing a nationwide campaign to reduce support for Medicare for All. You know, with all these moneyed interests trying to completely dismantle public support for Medicare for All, it is kind of fascinating how much they've failed, right? It is fascinating how many Americans still want a single payer healthcare system. And it's because you can't erase the torturous existence of having to deal with this maze of private health insurers. What will they cover? What don't they cover? Am I gonna go bankrupt? I mean, you have senior citizens going bankrupt right now because they can't afford their medical bills. And Medicare is wonderful, but it doesn't go far enough right now. A single payer Medicare system would put our resources into one system. We're all in that same system. We have actual power to bargain and negotiate prices for service, for pharmaceutical drugs, but they don't want that. They don't want that. The private industry hates the idea of that. The fundraiser, by the way, was also headlined by a CVS health lobbyist, as well as seven Democratic lawmakers who have raked in more than $5 million from donors in the pharmaceutical and healthcare sectors, including two whose top donating sector is the pharmaceutical industry. And why do they love Chantel Brown so much? That's Nina Turner's opponent. Well, get a load of her statement on Medicare for All. Medicare for All would eliminate employers from providing care for their employees. Okay, let's stop right there. I would want nothing more, than to not have to rely on my job for healthcare. Because as much as I love working at TYT, what if at some point I want to move on? What if at some point I want the freedom to look for maybe another profession, another job, without that fear of losing my health coverage? And by the way, I'm one of the lucky ones who enjoys what I do. Think about the Americans who are working jobs that they hate, they can't stand, and they feel like they're held captive by this health insurance issue, right? So I don't think Americans are like, I really like the fact that my employer can hold me hostage with healthcare. I think that's great, but Chantel Brown would have you believe that, you know, people love it. The rest of her statement, I know when I'm out in the community, there are some people who are satisfied with the healthcare they're being provided. I certainly don't want to be the person to end that. So we're not even, there's no discussion about taking healthcare away from Americans. The discussion is about how do Americans get the right coverage so they can see the doctor that they like and not have to worry about paying at the point of service. No copay, no deductible, no premiums, single payer system. You get to see the same doctor as long as they're accepting the single payer compensation for the services they provide. But like this idea that, oh no, you're not gonna be able to see your doctor anymore, they're gonna take the doctors away. That's not what this conversation is about. She's parroting the same corporate talking points that we were force fed during the 2016 and certainly the 2020 presidential election. And I do also wanna just give you a little bit of the media angling on this, because the headline from the New York Times is this: number three House Democrat steps into Ohio race to head off a Sanders acolyte. What? Who's running? Is Bernie Sanders running? Why can't they say Nina Turner's name or write Nina Turner's name in the headline? And the subheadline doesn't even specify that Nina Turner is running in this race. The decision by Representative James Clyburn to oppose an outspoken ally of Senator Bernie Sanders in a special election in Cleveland highlights the generational and ideological gulf in the Democratic Party. They seem like they're afraid to say her name. I mean, that headline and subheadline is laughable. And I do want to read you a few excerpts from the piece where the New York Times reporters say Turner is undoubtedly a divisive figure as well, a prominent surrogate for Mr. Sanders in 2016 and a national co-chairwoman for his campaign in 2020. She has never minced words about what she calls corporate Democrats. She has declined to say whether she voted for Ms. Clinton in 2016, and before Election Day in November, she suggested the choice between Donald J. Trump and Mr. Biden was the choice between a full bowl of excrement and half a bowl. I think that sounds pretty good and right on. So I'll tell you where you can donate money to Nina Turner's campaign. Let's put the graphic up. Go to that link, which is not the best link to go to, but we'll get you guys a better link in just a minute. I think it's hellosomebody.com, but we'll look that up. Anyway, so check out Nina Turner's campaign. She's actually fighting on behalf of the American people. She's actually fighting on behalf of the policies that would improve people's lives materially. We deserve better, and Nina Turner is willing to deliver. So please support her. All right, let's move on. One second, all right, so. The New York Times is reporting that the GOP, specifically Trump-related operatives, had infiltrated various Democratic groups in the West in an effort to destroy their chances of ensuring their candidates win, but more importantly, ensuring that Donald Trump had the upper hand in the 2020 election. What's fascinating about this story isn't just the fact that the operatives had infiltrated the Democratic organizations in Western states, but that they were also trying to infiltrate Republican groups that just weren't loyal to Donald Trump enough, so-called moderate Republican groups. So let me give you the details on what they found. Large donations to Democratic National Committee, $10,000 each, had brought Beau Mayer and Sophia LaRocca, or Rocha, tickets to the Democratic debate in Las Vegas. So this couple gives a massive donation to the DNC, and then they're able to go to the Democratic primary debate that took place in Las Vegas. But Mayer and LaRocca were part of an undercover operation by conservatives to infiltrate progressive groups, political campaigns, and the offices of Democratic as well as moderate Republican elected officials during the 2020 election cycle. Using large campaign donations and cover stories, the operatives aim to gather dirt that could sabotage the reputations of people and organizations considered threats to a hard right agenda advanced by President Donald Trump. So here's the couple posing in a cutesy little picture in Las Vegas on the day that the Democratic debate, primary debate took place for the 2020 elections. And they look like a lovely couple, right? And the Democratic Party was unsuspecting of the fact that they were actually pro-Trump Republican operatives that were looking to dig up dirt on the Democratic Party and progressives and progressive groups who were also, of course, trying to get their preferred candidate elected, and that was Senator Bernie Sanders. Now, at the center of the scheme was an unusual cast, a former British spy connected to the security contractor Eric Prince, and Susan Gore, a wealthy heiress to the Gore-Tex fortune. Publicly available documents in Wyoming also tied Mayer and LaRocca to an address in Cody used by the former spy, the British spy, Richard Seddon. Okay, so Richard Seddon plays a huge role in this effort. So what exactly happened? What did Seddon do? Well, Seddon aided a network of conservative activists trying to discredit perceived enemies of Trump inside the government, including a planned sting operation in 2018 against Trump's national security advisor at the time, H.R. McMaster, and helping set up secret surveillance of FBI employees and other government officials. Prince had set Seddon's work in motion, recruiting him around the beginning of the Trump administration to hire former spies to train conservative activists in the basics of espionage and send them on political sabotage missions. So that's pretty serious. And the way that this couple actually ended up getting caught was they weren't so great in making up the stories, right? So there's sometimes their claims wouldn't add up. You know, they would say things about why they were missing in action on some issues by making up a story, of course, and then changing the story later. So at one point, the Democratic Party in Wyoming decided to start like slowly but surely restricting LaRocca's access to the party's email system. And that was a smart thing to do. But mind you, they were blinded by the fact that this couple donated a large sum of money to the DNC. And so when you are fueled and when you're funded by various interests, when fundraising tends to be the most important thing in our political system, it's easy to be duped when someone provides a massive campaign contribution or a massive contribution to the Democratic Party. And so that's a problem, obviously, not only for the Democratic Party and our political system, but more importantly, not more importantly, but also it's a problem for the couple, because if they had made campaign donations or political contributions and then were reimbursed by an organization, Republicans, whatever, whoever was helping them pay for those contributions, that's illegal. That's what that dopey guy went to prison for. What's his name again? The one who's done a bunch of those movies. You guys will remember. The one who's, he was close with Ann Coulter. All right, we'll figure it out. I just totally blanked on his name. But there was a Republican operative who actually did end up going to prison as a result of that. And then later Trump had pardoned him. Now, let me give you some of their other tactics. So Seddon also secures the funding to do these operations from this Wyoming heiress. I mentioned her before, that's Susan Gore. She's very wealthy, very much against legalizing marijuana. For some reason, that's like the hill that she wants to die on. So she was very much involved in funding these operations, but she also has a long history of financing the Republican Party or any type of conservative effort that goes along with her views. One of the things that Sophia LaRocca did was she took a picture with a Democratic candidate who didn't end up winning a congressional seat that she ran for in Wyoming. And this was actually for the Wyoming legislature. The woman that she's pictured with is Marcy Kindred. Again, she didn't end up winning. But what was interesting was that Sophia LaRocca took this photo with her and then immediately posted it on Facebook as her profile picture. Right, and so that was another trick to make it seem like she was supportive of Democratic candidates. And Marcy Kindred said about that whole incident, it was kind of odd that she put it on Facebook. We weren't really that close. Now it makes total sense. She was playing the long game, trying to be my friend in the hopes of me getting into the legislature. And if she had gotten into the legislature and if they had a close relationship, maybe there's a possibility to get some personal information about her, dig up dirt about her, and slowly but surely destroy members of the Democratic Party, both on a local level, because this is the Wyoming legislature, but also on a national level as well with some of these national politicians. And then all of a sudden, the couple just disappeared. Right before the November election, Mayor Ann LaRocca disappeared on October 21st. She wrote an email to her boss saying that she had to leave the country, writing, quote, "I have a family emergency and am going to Venezuela as my grandmother is gravely ill." Others she had worked with and befriended over 2 years said they had not heard from her in months. But the New York Times actually found that in fact, the couple never left the area. Mayor and Seddon have also been working together on a business venture importing ammunition from overseas, according to a business document linking the two men that was obtained by the Times. By a document obtained by the Times. So money in politics has all sorts of ramifications, certainly when it comes to the policies that end up getting passed, but also when it comes to luring in Democratic lawmakers or Democratic organizations by Republican operatives or right-wing operatives, right? And they didn't just focus on Democrats here. They also focused on moderate Republicans as well, all in an effort to help Donald Trump. And by the way, where did these operatives come from? Project Veritas. So that whole organization is involved in all of this as well. So I think that people need to be smart, not just official Democratic organizations, but I see a lot of fascinating infighting with the left online. And just be careful when people tell you who they are and what they stand for and what they represent, because you can get away with a lot. And not everyone on the other end of that social media platform is being honest about their identity or honest about what they stand for. So I think it's okay to be skeptical. It's okay to, you know, have your eyes open. But more importantly, if you notice that there is a clear effort to sow division, if there's a clear effort to start conflict, ask yourselves why. Why is the least powerful group in this country, and those are the leftists, why are members of that group starting stuff for no reason and harping on it nonstop, week after week, month after month? Why do they want to sow division? I don't know. Maybe I'm being a little too suspicious, but don't believe everything you read on the internet. Be smart, because these operatives infiltrating groups, it's a thing. It actually does happen. And it's clear that it happens. We've seen it happen on social media with right-wing marketing campaigns posing as socialists. That was a story that we talked about in regard to Facebook just a few weeks ago. So keep your eyes out, listen to evidence, read. And when I say read, I don't mean read Twitter feeds. I mean read actual credible reporting, and just be smart, because we got to protect ourselves. And there are all sorts of nefarious figures that are well funded out there who have every interest to destroy any movement that goes against their corporate backers. All right, and then I got a text message from Brett. I want to make sure I give you guys that name. Dinesh D'Souza. That was what he went to prison for. Dinesh D'Souza was making campaign contributions on behalf of others, and it's a crime. That's why he went to prison. He's a criminal. Yeah. Anyway, let's take a break. When we come back, John Iadarola will be joining me for some more news.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Young Turks. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, Cenk Uygur, and I'll see you soon.